Welcome to another very special installment of Sunday Special, which we entitle Ancient Stone Structures in the Woods. For today's program, we're going to take you to the second of a series of 2016 historic collaborations coordinated by the Last Green Valley Incorporated, which, of course, is the stewardship organization, nonprofit, which facilitates us caring for, enjoying, and passing along the Last Green Valley National Heritage Corridor area for future generations. The historic collaborations, it is hoped, will, on an ongoing basis, provide a venue in which historians, teachers, museum curators, and those interested in history can share their experiences and their knowledge, so that throughout the Last Green Valley we can lockstep and unite as a resource for fun learning, education about the lives of those lived in the past here in our area and the overall history of the cultures and natural resources that form and have formed the area we call the Last Green Valley. The historic collaboration took place at the 1909 Turtlett Memorial High School in Thompson, Connecticut, and was hosted by the Thompson Historical Society. Coming up, you're going to hear a few brief introductions, after which the program will begin with the Thompson Historical Society's Joe Iamorino, sorry if I've mispronounced that, is going to be talking about lithic structures. That will be followed by the voice of Joe Lindley, who you will hear, historian, wonderful storyteller, and author, also from the Thompson Historical Society, who will primarily focus his remarks on Indian kerns, but the program, as you will hear, kind of runs the gamut from lithic structures to underground caverns, Native American weirs along the rivers, Indian memorial rock piles, kerns, so on and so forth. I think you're going to find the upcoming program compelling, not only because it's one that is rarely talked about in the media, and our presenters will get into the reason for that and why that's changing, but also because it's a fascinating, fascinating topic that directly relates to the history of all of New England, really. So let's get right to it. We take you now to the Turtlett Memorial High School for the historic collaboration held by the Last Green Valley Incorporated on Friday, May 20th, entitled Lithic Structures and Indian Kerns, presented by the Thompson Historical Society. Here is that program in its entirety.
Welcome everybody to Turtlett Memorial High School. This is the 1909 Riscavige Auditorium. Just to give you a brief, who's not been here? Alright, so some new people. This was an incredible, remarkable gift given to Tom Thompson by the Turtlotts, Dr. and Mrs. Harriet Turtlott. And we could spend a whole session on what they did for the town. But this school is one of the last of its kind that's still operating in some educational capacity. There's a museum across the hall that you're welcome to visit. We, based on our research, we think it's the largest public school museum in the country. And what's interesting about Turtlett Memorial High School is that in the time when philanthropy was big for the wealthy people, many of the wealthy people would go out and create academies. And they'd have private academies. And they'd have private academies so that wealthy people could develop schools for wealthy kids. Mrs. Turtlott wanted to do something different. And there's a reason why this school is located up here in the hill. That she literally wanted to show the kids of Thompson, all the mill worker children, the farming children, or anybody that was from the town, that there was a higher education available to them for free. So hence the school's up in the hill, a higher education. So it's a remarkable building. Feel free to walk around. The museum is open after, and then we also have one of the largest railroad engine picture collections in the country. That's, if you're a railroad enthusiast, you're going to love that place. All right. So without further ado, to present lithic structures. And Thompson is our president of the Historical Society, and certainly someone has spent more time on this topic than most people in the town of Thompson. So our president of the Historical Society, John Martino.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. First of all, I appreciate you coming out on a Friday, a nice Friday afternoon for this topic. This is an interesting topic for me. It's a little nostalgic, as Dave Johnson will attest, going back many years now when this thing started with us. Two things before I get started. We had a co-sponsor, and so our co-sponsor, Grand Valley. Marcy, if you just want to just stay a quick word about what's going on with your organization and why we're here together.
Yes, absolutely. History, we live in a National Heritage Corridor, 35 towns in Northeast Connecticut, South Central Massachusetts. This region was designated by Congress much like a national park, except we have much more than national parks. Instead of just the natural resources, we also have this fabulous history. And you'll have to forgive me because I talk to children a lot, but I always tell the children, hold up all 10 of your hands, all 10 of your fingers. This is all the last Green Valley. If you fold two down and you have eight left, about that much is still green. Forest, farms, rivers, woods. So that's a lot. If you hold up those two that are remaining, that's our developed or our schools, our museums, our libraries, our hospitals, our homes. So I think that's a pretty good ratio, and we have a lot of great finds out here, obviously. Probably a lot of things we walk past that we don't even know, and so that's why this kind of learning is a great environment. Now, we're going to do these quarterly historic things. We started with Killingly in January. We hope to be at Huntington sometime in August or September, and then perhaps I'm eyeballing Ashbel Woodward for sometime in the winter. But what we're going to try to do is each quarter go to a different location, have the experts talk about what they know about, and have us learn from each other. And so instead of us fighting along single-handedly, we're going to learn from each other and then become better and stronger. And I kind of feel like it's already happening because I know people are visiting each other like we are here tonight. We have been able to do a big push from the Last Green Valley, from our website, from our Facebook page, and that's what our purpose is. Our purpose is to educate about the region, have interregional tourism and travel and experiences, and then once we become so knowledgeable about each other's, people will come to our area as well as tourists. So for you tonight, I brought, interestingly enough, I found this information on the website ahead of time, so I printed out. It's a very small map, but it gives you a perspective of how much there is here in Thompson, in this region. It's the same map as that, just smaller, with also some photos that are on their website. I thought it was pretty interesting. So there's some of that in the snack room for everybody. What I've been doing for folks, Sunday I think what we'd love to do is do some kind of a seminar on modern technology, Facebook. A lot of the historical societies struggle with that. I get questions all the time. I'm not sure that I'm the one to teach everybody how to do it. I'm happy to share what I know, but I think there's probably somebody better. So at some point, we might have a nice seminar about that. We've got 3,200 likes or followers or whatever it is, and we've got 107 people subscribed to our events. So where I don't find your events already on Facebook, I create an event and I call it a historical happening in the Last Green Valley. And I feel like more people are finding out about what you guys are doing. So be sure to tell me what you have going on so I can share. I'm having a tough time keeping up with you guys, but I'm doing it. I'm bruised. I got poison ivy. I got bug bites. But running here and there and everywhere, it's doing great. And if anybody sees a tick on me tonight, please point that out. I'd appreciate it. And last of all, our new Explore Guide just came out on Friday. I've been hitting throughout the National Heritage Corridor. I've got extras over there in the snack room as well. The snacks look pretty good. I didn't make them, so that's probably why. So after we're done, we can all have some snacks. No coffee. I don't want anybody complaining they can't sleep tonight. So.
That's right.
All right. Here's Joe.
Thank you very much, Marcy. So I'm just practicing. Okay, it's working. First of all, you might want to check your cell phones just to make sure in the vibrate mode. I never met Mr. Whittall, but I feel like I did because I've read a lot of the things that he's written, and I don't want to embarrass Dave Johnson just yet. We'll have to wait for that. But Mr. Whittall, well-known authority on megalithic architecture, he wrote this line. There are some very strange, rude stone monuments in the Thompson area and compared to the rest of New England, and it's very true. If you look at just the number of sites that we have here, there's so much water in Thompson, and that's a very unique thing that makes it very interesting probably from those who built some of the structures that we're going to talk about tonight. Dave, here you are. You might recognize this at the Chambers, this East Thompson Chamber, and with the late Jane Johnson. We want to remember their contributions to what we're talking about tonight. And tonight's a little bit sensitive in the sense that we have not, until now, as a historical society, really come out and talked openly about these things. Everything's been whispered and hinted at, and we go from cell to cell, town to town, and there's these little secretive groups who are telling, hey, I'll tell you where it is, I'll show you where it is. But we can't tell each other. So I know dozens and dozens of towns and been visiting the things, and yet they don't know each other. People don't know each other in many of these ways. So we're going to try to change a little bit of that, and we'll talk why. East Thompson Chamber. Now, there's always these questions about what is this type of a structure? Is this something that was built by Native Americans, or was it a colonial effort? And what was the purpose and the use of it? Clues and questions always arise. And one of the things I'm going to try to do tonight is I'm not here to say, oh, that's exactly what it was used for. Because even now, with many books which are listed here, and talking to dozens and dozens of people far more learned on the subject than I am, the answer is a lot of things aren't really known. How I came to this topic is I didn't come to it from walking through the woods. I didn't come to it from going to presentations. I came it from the books, the firsthand text. So I'm looking at the 1600s and the first people who came here and what they saw. And that's how I stumbled on it. And then we had people who said, well, if you're interested in that, why don't you come see what it looks like today? Because some of it actually still exists. I said, great, let's start looking at it. So I'm going to try to tie both sides together, the ancient literature and some of what we're actually seeing. I like this graphic. Hopefully you can see it in the back. We have John Eliot, the approximate locations of the praying villages back in 1675, King Philip's War. And there was a text, and an old text, which we reference later, where there was some Indian involvement, Native American involvement, in where these sites were actually placed. So everyone thinks, oh, John Eliot put a pin on a map and he said, we're going to put it here. That's common thought, but it wasn't that way. He was actually researching, and he was told by many of the chiefs or the leaders that this was a particularly good place to put a village for us. And so I want to, at some point, continue the research on that particular topic, because if we look at these different sites, we'll notice that there are certain things that are unique about those sites. They have very unusual clusters of certain structures, and we'll get to some of that a little bit later. Again, Mr. Johnson has been featured in the Boston Globe, and there's this mystery of how old some of these structures are. So we know that in this particular case, the article mentions that it was used as early perhaps 1200 AD. That's pretty early. Topics abound about what the structure is used for. So one of the things that we're going to talk about is what kind of structure it really is, what's going on inside, what's going on with it. Corbel's chamber inside in some of these structures. Very unique. No, nothing binding it together. And one of the other things about the chambers is there's not venting. So in some of the chambers, which may be colonial structure, there's a vent going on. In these, there's no venting. The other thing is you look inside and you won't see charcoal. You won't see any soot on the structure, on the surface of these structures. There are a few that do have it, but most of them don't have soot. So that tells us that there was many of these never had fire inside of them. So the fire was on the outside in the front patio, maybe, where it was. So, purpose. I'm coming at it again from the writing, from the writings, okay? Not from theories. I'm talking about early writings. So we have several documents going back to the 1700s talking about potato tombs or root cellars. But these are outside, not inside of a home. These are outside potato tombs. Walter Eddy spent a lot of time talking to me about potato tombs. Was this a potato tomb? East Thompson was a potato tomb? Maybe not. Hiding place, burial chambers. We have in East Thompson a very famous chamber, Hoyle's tomb. Lots of legends that it was, what was the last one we had? It was an ice house. We had ice houses is the idea. And there are similar ice houses, there's no doubt, but that was not that case. The case of Hoyle's tomb has been, literally the silver stake has been placed through it. Mark Snay found the actual document where it was turned over to the town. So we have reference now, the exact date when the family said it was a tomb, it was built as a tomb, and it was given to the town as a tomb. So we know that. Sweat hut, a bath, a kiln. We have references, and I'll show you the actual I'll show the actual words that came out of the text, where many kilns, because someone had to fire some of this pottery, but that's not probably what this was, because there's nothing going on inside of it, really, that we're talking about. So is it a sweat hut? Possibly. We have documents that talk about similar structures, Celtic, Irish, Viking structures, still using these today. So my goal here right this second is not to tell you which of these theories is the correct one. We'll let the document speak for itself, and then you can draw your own conclusions. Again, bringing back Jane Johnson, you'll see some of these cairn sites. Some of these cairns are quite tall. So you have stone piles, very low ones. You have very tall cairns, and some of these are even better built than this one. Very famous historian in this space, Malcolm Pearson, Tamla Cairns. Very nice structure there. Now, other ones, I'm not going to say all of these are from Thompson, Connecticut. Some are from the Thompson area. Some are from northeastern Connecticut. But I want to just use some of these as a reference. What is this, a whale? Is it considered an effigy shape? Is it a turtle? Is it a snake? So we know that some of these structures have these unique things to them. You can see flippers up at the word site on some turtles. It's very interesting to see how these things were actually created. So again, this is another example of one. Back at the word site, we have some different types of cairns. So you have some erratic boulders with a cairn built on top. It's a lot of work to build that, especially if you have to carry the rocks uphill. Some of these are not from the top down. These had to be brought up. One of the things that happened at a NERA event that I was at, I think Joe Lindley and my son went, and Doug Harris from the Narragansett Indians. If you know Doug and talk to Doug quite a bit, Doug was pretty adamant about this topic, that what the heck are you digging up, taking our cairns apart? Would you go over to your local cemetery and feel comfortable? Yeah, I'm going to just dig it up tonight. No, we wouldn't do that. So is it a form of disrespect or is it archaeology to want? What happens if you get 500 years past where we are now? Is it okay to start digging then? So we would never dig now, but a couple hundred more years from now, is it okay? At what point do you cross over the line and it's okay? I'm not here to say I know the answer, but I do want to point out to you that these have names on it, people's dates. But what about this type of a site? You're over here at the Dyke Family Cemetery, where you have unnamed smallpox victims with crude markers. You don't even know what's going on with some of these. So how do you feel about digging up that one? I mean, I think you get the idea. We have an 1880s Woodstock map where it actually says Indian graves on it. And part one of our initiatives over the next couple of months is to get out there, and we know exactly where the marking said the Indian graves were. We're going to go out and see what they thought was what that was 130 years ago. We want to know. Mr. Chase, I hope you'll help us with that mission. Thank you for coming tonight. So are they all stone piles or cairns? And can we call those graves, real graves, or are they just mental memorials? Sonny Reynolds, well known in Thompson, would say this was certainly a thunder rock. For those who know what it is, great. If you don't, the idea was it's a big boulder like this that was very precariously perched, could be rocked. And when it hit, it would make a tremendous sound that would go for a very long distance. I wasn't there. Sonny says it happened. I believe Sonny. I've seen things he's written, and he's pretty truthful so far. This is in Thompson. The next one, you can barely see it, but I hope you can. There's a little indentation in the rock. And you walk by, and most people would just ignore it. Maybe you wouldn't know what you're seeing. But then if you look at it when that rock is a little more discreet, you can get the idea that it might be more than just a casual hole in a rock. It actually is a grinding spot. And you go around, especially in Maine. In Maine, they have many of those. And you go by the side of the path or the side of the road, and you'll see it just sitting there. And there's so many of them that you can see. These are various examples. But one little trait, if you're interested, is that there's some that have a very deep hole, and some have kind of a scoop, and some have a very rounded shape. Those three shapes have some differences. So the one I want to talk is the top right. Acorns. The acorn one required the little deeper shape, and you had to have a more elongated pounding tool to be able to handle the acorns. Acorns are, you can still buy acorn flour today. I advise you to try it once, and I wouldn't advocate you do that more than one time. The other aspect of it is, why might you have a more sloped surface versus the round indentation? Is that it was based on the type of stones that you had. Some people had access to these longer roller type, and other people could only find the pounders. So these pounders, These pounders here, I found one at the bottom of a well. It was certainly, you can hold it, you can see where the sweat from the hand discolored the pounder. And it's a very interesting piece of lithic structure. Several of these have been incorporated into different areas. I'll give you an example. There's a church in Oxford that has one of these that's been, now it's a baptismal font. So you go up there and you can get the holy water, and you don't realize you're using maybe a pagan corn thing. You know what I'm saying? So I don't know. It seems like an interesting use of it. Okay, David Wagner. Many of you know David Wagner. I'm just giving him credit. He gave us some documents to the Historical Society, as well as paintings that he has done. And I'm just using an example here. The donation or memory pile. Again, coming at it from the written literature, we have numerous, I'm talking dozens of examples of documents that talk about the Indians themselves are not sure why they're doing this, but their father told them to do it, and so they're doing it. Every time they would walk up, they would have to get a stone and put it on the pile. They don't remember who was there and who they're remembering, but they're doing it. If it was just one document that said it or two documents that said it, it's just an accident. When you see dozens and dozens, now you start to get the trend something more is happening here. We also have V-shaped, in the woods, you have V-shaped stone walls, and they don't continue. They only go for a short period of time, and they're really strange looking because they have an opening at the bottom end of it. So this is a deer weir. I'm not sure if I'm saying it right, but the idea is you would have people beating drums or making noises or pounding stones together. The Indians would drive the animals to this central point, and there you would be able to get your tomorrow's meal. This is another David Wagner depiction. Now, chambers, there's many chambers, as you probably heard, in the Thompson area and all throughout northeastern Connecticut and Massachusetts. Some of the chambers may not be Native American or Indian or Vikings. They're not early. But what you have to look for is you have to look for clues. You have to look for what types of things might be inside of it. So in this particular area, you can see an area where there was an iron drill at the very top of it. That's a clue. There weren't any iron drills up to a certain point. There's other things that you can look at. The use of, and you have to look where. Sometimes you have to look where is it. If you're actually inside of the chamber itself, and you'll see bits of little brick, little tiny pieces of brick are mixed in. And you might be able to see that there's a little piece here, and there's several others. You also, on the floor, if you do some scraping, and I'm not advocating you do any of this, but let the archaeologists do that, they'll find in the scrapings, they'll find broken pieces of glass at certain layers where it's pretty obvious that it was brought in by a colonial person doing this work. So there's in several of those books over there, they talk about how to identify, is this a colonial, pre-colonial, or something more recent? Hopefully you can see back there, David Wagner has done a very interesting drawing of the construction of a fish weir. So several places on the Quinebaug, you can go out and see it. This is what it might look like today. It's a very interesting structure. And you wonder why it was there. Then when the Indians were actually using it, according to David Wagner's vision, this is what he did. There was a structure, and you would have baskets. And when it was all done, you can see the baskets here. They would take and smoke the fish up on one of their seasonal villages. So this village would not stay there all year round. They would come for a couple of months, smoke the fish, preserve it, and stay cool during the summer, and then move on for winter quarters. So again, thank you, Mr. Wagner, for your vision of how that might have looked. Okay, so this is the part of the physical evidence. Now, how about eyewitness accounts? So the one of them that I would advocate is George Catlin, and he died in 1872. And if you read many of the things that he's written, he was an artist who was absolutely fascinated by the Native Americans all around the country. Originally from the Philadelphia School of Art, what I mean by that, not the school itself, but the area of Philadelphia where he practiced his craft. Once he had the bug, he wanted to go out there and document what the Native Americans were like in person. So he had a chance to meet them, he painted them. But he documented that the Mandan Indians had kilns built into the sides of hills or riverbanks. Kilns. Now, you have to fire pottery in some cases, but there will be many. I would love to have someone who's familiar with the type of Indian pottery, because there was unfired pottery. I would love to know more about this topic. Certain things about kilns is you have to have a vent in kilns because you fire it up. My understanding is you have to have a vented kiln in order to be successful. So I'm not an expert here. I would love someone to come forward and help me with the idea, could this be a kiln?
There is documented evidence of a person who physically was there and met these people. Now, we have another one, Abner Sanger, 1774, out of Maine. He helped secure the sauce in their potato tomb or their potato hole. And this was not in the house. This was outside. So, okay, what was that? What was a potato tomb? Don't know. No one had cameras then. Couldn't determine it. The famous one, Roger Williams in 1643, and I'm going to read this, talking about, I'm assuming it's Pessupunk, a hothouse. This hothouse is a kind of a little cellar cave, 6 or 8 foot over, round, made on the side of a hill, commonly by some rivulet or brook. Into this frequently the men enter after they have exceedingly heated it with a store of wood, and they laid upon a heap of stones in the middle. So this one says that they heated it with a store of wood, but we'll see in other examples that may not be exactly true. When they have taken out the fire, the stones keep still a great heat. 10, 20, 12, 20 more or less enter at once, stark naked, leaving their coats, small breeches or aprons at the door, with one to keep all. Here do they sit around these hot stones an hour or more, taking tobacco, discoursing, sweating together, which sweating they use for two ends. First, to cleanse their skin. Secondly, to purge their bodies, which doubtless a great means of preserving them and recovering them from diseases, especially from the French disease, syphilis, which by sweating and some potions they perfectly and speedily cure. When they come forth, which is a matter of admiration, I've seen them run, summer and winter, into brooks to cool them without the least hurt. So there it is, 1643 is one document. This is 1672. Now, this is much farther north, the Mi'kmaq in Canada. A little round wigwam covered with bark. So this one is a little different, doesn't have stone. Covered with bark top to bottom, closed with the exception of a little opening for entering. Large rocks were gathered and placed in a fire and made red hot. After this, those who wished to sweat placed themselves wholly naked in the wigwam, seated on their buttocks all around. Their wives or some boys gave them the rocks red hot with a big dish full of water and another small dish for pouring the water upon the rocks, which were placed in the middle of the circle. The water made a steam, filled the cabin, heated so much that it made them sweat. They remained there as long as they could, stuck it for an hour and up to an hour or 2 hours. During this time, they chanted the songs, told stories to make themselves laugh. Similar stories, though. Notice how the similarity. Now, President Grant, before he was a president, was a soldier wandering on the West Coast. This one is in California. It was a steam bath. Something like a bake oven was built, large enough to admit a man lying down. Bushes were stuck in the ground in two rows, 6 feet long, about two or three feet apart. Other bushes connected the rows at one end. The hole was then plastered over with wet clay until every opening was filled. Just inside the open end of the oven, the floor was scooped out so as to make a hole that would hold a bucket or two of water. These ovens were always built on the banks of a stream, a big spring, or a pool of water. When a patient required a bath, a fire was built near the oven and a pile of stones put upon it. The cavity in front was then filled with water. When the stones were heated, the patient would draw himself into the oven, a blanket would be thrown over the open end, and hot stones put into the water until the patient could stand it no longer. He was then withdrawn from his steam bath and doused in the cold stream nearby. So, and there's dozens of these. I think we get a picture now. Okay, so this is the advertising part of the show. I belong to a group called NERA.org. Dave and Jane introduced me to this organization. I've been a member for many years now. And NERA supports research and protection of these sites. I strongly advocate anybody who's interested in the topic is go to their site, pay for their newsletter, and attend their meetings. Okay, so now we're going to move over to a cairn field. And you can see the various cairns stacked up. There are low piles, and there's larger cairns. The Santee of South Carolina, where an Indian is slain, in that place they make a heap of stones. To this memorial, every Indian that passes by adds a stone to augment the heap in respect to the deceased hero. This is the history of South Carolina from 1714, early. Okay, this is from Mr. Squire, Antiquities of New York, 1851. And this gentleman associated with Yale. Occasional large heaps of stone, the work of Aborigines, are to be found in the state of New York. Particular reference was made to one in Schoharie County, which is described more in detail in Howe's Gazetteer of New York as follows. Between Schoharie Creek and Cahuaga was an Indian trail, and near it, in the north bounds of Schoharie County, has been seen from time immemorial a large pile of stones, which is given the name of Stone Heap Patent to the tract of which it occurs, as may be seen from ancient deeds. Indian tradition says that a Mohawk murdered his brother on this spot and that this heap was erected to commemorate the event. Every individual who passed that way added a stone to the pile, propitiation of the spirit of the victim. Now, over and over and over, this comes up, this idea that the stone is carrying on a victim who died too early. So there seems to be that common theme. It's not just if you just die, maybe you get picked apart by birds and you're wrapped up in a bundle and that's it. But if something happened to you that you met an unexpected death, somehow you got the stone pile. And I don't know why. It just seems to be a trend. Again, I would love someone to take this story on and carry on and do more research and write a paper and get a book and be famous. The Thompson Historical Society has collected many excerpts from texts describing these lithic sites. I've been just asking people over and over, whenever you find one, send it to me. And so we've been carrying on this long, long list. We need somebody at some point who really has the need, the desire, the angst here. And sometimes people get really frustrated when you just don't get this thing told. Joe Lindley's one of those. Joe Lindley has to tell a story. So that's why he writes his books. So somebody's going to get the passion, maybe somebody here, is to take this thing and run and get this story told, because it really needs to be told better. If you got any ideas, new excerpts, send them over, please. The times are changing. So this idea that the secrecy was necessary, people had to be quiet about this. We couldn't tell things. Well, look what it's done for us. About 50% of the sites that were known maybe even 30 years ago, they're not here anymore. People are selling the stone. I've heard stories, a chamber or more taken down because too many people were coming to visit, and there's no protection for it. So the strategy's not working well. So maybe the idea is really we have to start talking about it a little bit more and try a new approach. And so with that, I'm going to turn the story over to Mr. Lindley, and he'll carry on.
See if we can switch this over. Okay, some of this is going to be a little redundant to Joe, but to give you a little bit of my history with this topic. I can do that in about 30 seconds because it's relatively new. I became interested in this particular topic about a year and a half or so ago. Because Joe was after me, since I've been a member of the Thompson Historical Society, you've got to go see this site, you've got to go see this site, it's absolutely magical. And back then, I was so involved with the Civil War and some of the other projects I was working on in the Turtle Out Building that I didn't understand it. One of the things that we do know is that when I first visited the Word site, I became painfully aware that how little we knew or know about the people that occupied this area. They were all over the place, and they went back thousands of years. Our perspective as post-colonial descendants or immigrants is so narrow when compared to the entire history of this area. It's just a little tiny speck. And we didn't know, because they didn't leave a written language, we don't know a whole bunch about what they did, who they were, how they lived. But we do have evidence that they were here. As an amateur historian, I certainly understand the biggest problem was their lack of recorded history, but using their sites, we can learn so much. But when I started investigating some of the sites, I could say that, you know, the haphazard way in which we handled this wasn't enabling us to tell the story. When I started looking at just Thompson and what we know, Carolyn Words and her commission does a lot of work in this area. I put together in my own amateurish, sophomoric way the list of sites that we have our hands around. This is only a small representation of the sites that exist in our area. Thompson, Woodstock, Putnam, Webster were huge areas for many, many hundreds of years for these people. And you can see the number of sites that were there. And we know there's more. And we know there was many more destroyed. Some of what we know about our local sites go back to the 1700s. This is the William Chandler survey that goes back to 1749. And this little piece right up here is listed as an old fort. And when you look at that, you can see it there is listed again as an old fort. That's Fort Hill. Even in the 1700s, which isn't that long ago, there was evidence in Thompson of these huge areas. We know there was a village up on Thompson Hill, and we know this redoubt existed. And it makes some sense that, we'll talk about it a little bit more, the Indians were always vying for land, so the Mohegans and the Pequots and the Nipmucks and all the others, the Narragansetts, were all vying for land, so there was a lot of fighting that went on. You know, not all the time, but there was some, and they needed these redoubts. No different than what we do today. Some of the redoubts, we don't know exactly what the fort on Thompson Hill looked like, but this is a very typical fort. It was probably a round structure with one opening that they could get in and hide and kind of fend off any attack or something along those lines. And what we found in the 1934 flyover, now I'm not saying that this was the fort. What I'm suggesting is there was evidence in 1934 that there was something there. And if you can look on the south side of Fort Hill, what we know is the marker is up in this area here. There's these outlines that existed back in 1934. We're not sure what they are. But the point of what we're trying to talk about tonight is these are the types of sites we need to protect in order for smarter people to come along and figure out exactly what was going on in that area. This is Henry Payne, the last of the Nipmuc Indians, or so they thought in 1939. But Henry Payne wasn't the last of the Nipmuc Indians. There's a long line of Nipmucs. There's a lot of Nipmucs that are around. That bloodline still exists today, and they're very active today. So when we looked at, if it gives you a mindset of what we were going through back in the early 1900s. I just finished writing a book called Forgotten Hero about Calvin Heath, who was a Nipmuc Indian. He was, as a sixth grader, was made to stand in the corner because the teacher, he said he was a Nipmuc Indian. His mother was Nipmuc. And back then, this would have been 1959 or something along those lines, he was made to stand in the corner because the teacher insisted there are no more Indians left in this area. So we thought, you know, we extinguished them. They were gone. Everything that they stood for, all their history was gone. We couldn't have been more wrong. Even in our own time, some of you are going to recognize this area. This is Quintessit Country Club. This pond has been there for a very long time, so it's pretty certain that there might have been some cairns or some memorials or monuments around that pond. Because that's where the Indians typically go. They typically run the water or the swamps or something like that. So we know when Norman Ream built this area as a golf course, we know that there was probably something destroyed back then. That was in the early 1900s.
As late as a few years ago, this area here, this is the area I live in, and I own some land in here, I had a neighbor that went in and not only logged out the logs, but they went in this area and they logged out all the stone walls, all the stone piles, every piece of rock that was out there. And when I asked my neighbor, you know, do you understand that there might have been some ancient sites in there? Because we do know that in this area was all swamp. So there was nothing from a farming standpoint that could have gone on here. As a matter of fact, the old farm stopped around here and came out this way. So we do know that with Munson Brook coming out of this pond over here, there was probably some Indian sites there that were destroyed. They were gone in a week. They came in with a big payloader, bulldozer, pushed the rocks together, and off they went.
I have a Manitou stone that came from that area.
This is the 1934 flyover of the same area, and you can see that there was no farming going on. There was some logging, because they logged everywhere, because that's how they heated their houses and built everything. But Munson Brook comes out and comes down through here, so we're pretty certain that there might have been something there. So when I asked my neighbor, do you understand there's something ancient? No clue. Absolutely no clue. All they were to her were big piles of stones and stone walls. No significance. And even the stone walls that we do know, that some of the stone walls in this area were built by the Indians. Who knows how many hundreds of years ago? 1,000, maybe 2,000 years ago. We don't know. But, you know, our lack of education to people, especially in our area, and what boggles my mind is that we destroy these sites for a couple $100. This is Carolyn and Bob Words. They're sitting over there. They have one of the most significant sites in our area, and they wanted to do something different. They didn't want to just pass it on to the next owner. They wanted to try to see what they could do to preserve the site. And when Joe Armatino got me interested in this, he said, you got to come up and see this site. You won't believe it. And I was still in my pile of rock mode. They're piles of rock. Yeah, I get the whole monument thing, Joe. This was a few years back. But when I went up, we went and we come up to this rise, this ridge that was there, and it was absolutely magical. Somehow I felt transported back 1,000 years. Somehow I felt there were other people around me. There were spirits around me. Mother Earth was around me. Whatever you want to call it, I felt I was there. And all those are cairns. Over 100 cairns in this small piece of land. And who knows why they were there, what they were for. And one of the things that that I found, it was interesting for me. I'm a former combat arms officer in the Army. So to me, looking at it from a military perspective, they have this beautiful ridge, and if you follow the ridge line, it goes into Webster Lake. So I'm thinking that if you're going to defend yourself against an attack, that's where you normally would be. So I'm thinking as a military guy, these are all positions saying to myself, boy, if I had a major attack in this area right now and I was the Nipmucks, this is where I would be. If I was the Mohegans coming in from the south, here's where I would come in from. So I'm starting, my mind goes all kinds of wild, and I'm thinking the concentration of these cairns might indicate that there was a battle there, and like Joe said, there could have been memorials from fallen braves that were, whose lives were taken too early. I don't know. I have no clue, and I'm not even close to being qualified to answer those questions. The amateur historian in me understands that they could have been built by the Irish. They could be post-colonial. They could have been piles of stone that were built by farmers. We don't know. But what's interesting about this particular part of the discussion is that the Words recognized that this is important for someone else to understand this better. Here's some other sites that were there, a beehive site. You can tell this is not just a pile of rock. This took some skill to build. Every time I've gone there, I've gone several times, and every time we go there, we see something different. This one here kind of took, you can see like there's a little archway here, and there's a flat stone with an opening. That kind of intrigued me. There was a little niche there, and what's interesting is when you look at it, it's facing south. So I can almost imagine that possibly this was made for some offering. Who knows? There were several like that that we found. And the word site also has these several boats, these kinds of boats that are just humongous in size, and it must have taken hundreds of hours to build these things. This is one that is on the property, and you can see the shape. Again, just absolutely magical. When the Wurges were getting, we all age, and at some point you got to decide what are you going to do at the tail end of your life. I'm trying to figure out that with my kids. I'm not leaving them all the money. The heck with that. I'm going to spend it. So my decision's already been made. They approached us a few years ago to see if there was an option other than just passing the land on to the next owner and hoping they would do the right thing. And it was all new to us. None of us understood the ramifications, the responsibilities, or anything going on with regards to that line of thinking. And they sought some legal advice as to what are the options that I can do with the land? What can we do? So after a lot of discussion between Carolyn and Bob with Joe, they decided that maybe we can do something different. Maybe we can protect these things, and maybe we can do it differently than other people do it, so that we can preserve these sites, so you can have another Joe Lindley who can dream up some other reason why those things were built, and we can have experts go in and study this stuff without destroying it. You know, because we don't know what the next owner is going to do. So they came up with a conservation, preservation, and maintenance easement. And the remarkable thing that they did that we've not seen in this area is that they made this, there's a statement that says the stone structures or cairns are believed to be Native American in origin. However, to date, there has been no verifiable evidence to prove their origins or their purpose. They remain a mystery until proven otherwise. For this reason, they should be preserved and the Thompson Historical Society is entrusted with their preservation. They signed over an easement making the Thompson Historical Society responsible for their protection. It's an incredible step in toward preservation of these sites. Nobody in this area has done that. So the question before us, to kind of reiterate what Joe was saying, is that has the work that we've done worked? When I first came into this whole discussion and read all these books and went to NARA meetings, there's two things that I found. One was, we don't talk about it because nobody wants to know. You know, we don't want them destroyed. I'll show you. Might have to wear a blindfold so you don't know where we're going. But I'll show you. But it's a big secret. And like Joe said, that has not worked because my next door neighbor was a prime example of 117 acres of stonework ripped apart for a couple hundred bucks. You know, and it was because she didn't know. So we do know that what we've done in the past number of decades isn't working. So what we've done, has it worked? My amateur opinion is no, it hasn't worked because people don't know what these things are. Do we really understand what we have? When we go to that site, Joe sees something different. Mark sees something else. I see this big military battle. There's all kinds of things going on. Do we understand completely what these things are? No. But we've got to preserve it so those that follow can go in and study it better than we can. And how do we protect what's left? So my piece of this discussion is that for all of us that are involved in history or part of historical societies or towns or whatever, is that maybe the Wurges example can start a more meaningful discussion on how to protect these sites. We do know there's hundreds of these monuments in Thompson, Connecticut. We do know that there's probably hundreds in Woodstock. We do know that the Falls of Putnam were a significant site for the Indians. All their remnants have probably been destroyed by now. We do know that they exist. So we've got to have that open discussion between Thompson and Woodstock and Webster, Massachusetts, and Putnam, and all the towns around this area, say, how do we work jointly to protect these sites? My personal opinion, I think what the Wurges did is the example of how we move forward with that. And that's my piece. We do have one more thing.
before I read this, I do want to say that there are land trust people here who have done wonderful work in that space as well. So thank you, Mr. Tillen, for your work in the land trust area. We know land trust people are also working this process as well. So again, thank you for that. I'm going to read a proclamation from the Thompson Historical Society. This is a historical preservation award. The Thompson Historical Society is pleased to present the Historical Preservation Award to Carolyn and Robert Wurge of Thompson, Connecticut. This award is presented to individuals or organizations that have gone above and beyond in their efforts to preserve our history. The conservation preservation easement they created will forever protect one of the most significant Karn sites in America, allowing future generations to learn about these ancient structures. Their action will be used as a template for others who wish to protect similar sites. It is with extreme gratitude this award is bestowed upon Carolyn and Robert Wurge. Thank you very much. Glad to do it. Thank you again. Well, that's our presentation for tonight. We appreciate you coming. If you have any questions, maybe you would like to gather around here and look at the books and talk amongst ourselves. Otherwise, we can let you go on to your next area.
I'll be in the museum if anybody wants to visit there, and we'll have the railroad room open as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to, in its entirety, the second historic collaboration hosted by the Last Green Valley Incorporated, held on Friday, May 20th, 2016, at the Turtlet Memorial High School in Thompson, Connecticut, and presenters courtesy of the Thompson Historical Society, bringing forth a fascinating and very, very important topic. A note that many of our listeners are familiar with Norwich resident Mike Menders, who has been studying strange structures, well, we might refer to as strange structures, henges, and underground stone structures around the world, and specifically here in New England and in southeastern Connecticut. And he's been doing that for nigh on 40 years or more. Mike is currently, or will be in a few days, up in Vermont visiting some very important sites in that state. And we look forward to Mike returning and doing another program with us very soon. We also are hoping that we're going to be able to actually go out exploring with Mike and record that for you for a future offering of Sunday Special. We know that the town of North Stonington has had some important conversations and meetings on the subject of stone structures and cairns and like artifacts in the woods in their town. And that's an ongoing conversation, one that we hope that more and more towns and communities across the Last Green Valley and across all of New England will start to have. Because, as you heard pointed out in the program we just listened to, the strategy of, shh, don't tell anybody, it's a secret, hush, hush, hasn't worked. And finally, a personal note from yours truly. If you have teenagers or kids who like to go out in the woods and party, urge them to, if they come across what seems to be an unusual structure of uncertain origin, not to destroy it, vandalize it, or trash it. Rather, leave it stand for the curious. For it is that curiosity, that interest in knowing more about our history, that will season and improve our future. Thank you for joining us today for Sunday Special. I'm Kevin Harkins.